Welcome to the Barbara Schulte Show with host Barbara Schulte and producer Ben Self. The Barbara Schulte Show brings conversations, stories, and tips intended to power up a writer's potential for more success, fun, and the confidence to ride and live with grace, courage, and the grit to never give up.
Hey, it's Barb. And in this episode, you'll meet Dr. Jim Lehrer, a world-renowned sports psychologist and high-performance coach who has trained over 400,000 people in his career, from Olympians to professional athletes to business executives. And I'm so grateful to say he trained me as a personal performance coach for the equestrian world. He is one of my true life heroes and mentors. And you'll hear Dr. Lehrer share his story along with some of the most important insights of his research and career. And you'll discover how to be an extraordinary writer, not only from a performance perspective, but also what it takes to be a happy and fulfilled person. He speaks of our private voice, energy management, authenticity, and the hard work of investing effort into what matters most to each one of us. I hope you love this interview as much as I do. For me, it was like coming home to visit a dear friend whose wisdom once again amazed me. Well, Dr. Lehrer, Jim, I just cannot tell you how thrilled I am to be with you. I mean, I just have this smile that's going from ear to ear. It's been too long. So welcome to the show.
Oh, I can't tell you how excited I am. You're one of my absolute favorite people. And the time that you went through the program and all the work that we did together on the mental toughness and tried to do something in the equestrian industry, I was so taken with your passion, with your intelligence, and with your kindness. You're a very special person. When I think of you, I think of eloquence. You're a very eloquent person, and it was really a privilege to work with you, and I think I probably learned a heck of a lot more from you than you did from me. It was really really exciting to learn about your competencies and the area that you specialize in. I am so excited to reconnect. We haven't really had a chance to reconnect for a very long time. So thank you for the opportunity to do this.
Yes, thank you. Well, thank you for being willing to be with us. So my first question to you is, I want to know, after meeting me and some of my cowgirl cohorts who came down to Orlando, Florida, originally, probably in the early 90s, late 80s, and I know you've met some other equestrians, are you ready to trade the tennis racket in for a horse? Have you done that yet?
You know, I haven't, but I've thought very seriously about it. That was a new experience for me. I have to tell you, I've had a lot of unusual, you know, we had a sumo wrestler from Japan come and stay with us for 6 months, and we had chess champions and every conceivable sport, but no one kind of rode in and took over like you did with your cohorts. That was really something, and I really found it fascinating. The more you talked about it, and the more you kind of helped me understand what some of the issues were, the more intrigued I became. And then I really was, you know, when I think of a horse whisperer, I think of you.
Uh-huh. Oh, well, that's kind. Well, I think your greatest accomplishment is that you have invented a new equestrian discipline. So I think you should tell everyone about that.
Well, not too many people know about barrel jumping. And that's how much I knew about the equestrian world. And you corrected me many times, Jim. It's not barrel jumping.
Well, what happened is, you know, when we first met and you were talking about perhaps certifying me as a personal performance coach.
Yes.
You said you were asking me about the equestrian discipline, and I don't know why, but I chose. I wanted to represent the English world and the Western world, and mm-hmm. I chose barrel racing and then jumping for the English. And then
I made that barrel jumping.
That's right, exactly. So I always really teased you about that.
Well, that really shows you how much I knew. The thing that I was most fascinated with was that I realized that the equestrian competencies, and it really is a team sport. It's with you and the horse. You're not only managing your own chemistry, you're managing your own stress and your own performance, but you're also managing this massive beast that you're sitting on and all of the stress hormones that are flowing through your body get communicated very quickly to the horse. And if you're tight, the horse gets tight. If you're having a great time and is relaxed, the horse can feel that. And I'm going, this is really, it's almost the almost as if the horse is a mirror of the rider. And I found that, then I got into looking at the research on that and really was intrigued by how much there really is, the way you carry yourself, your muscle tension, your breathing. All of that is important for you, but it's also important for the horse. And you never think so much, you know, you think about athletes in sport being great athletes, having this extraordinary ability, some being a little strong-willed or a little, you know, kind of wild and crazy. Well, you have all that with a horse as well. They have bad days. They have days where they're grumpy and grouchy and don't want to perform. And when you have all of that, and then you have all the rider's issues, you've got really quite an extraordinary, you know, performance that's about to occur. So you taught me a lot about how complex and how wonderfully challenging this area of sport really is, and it's a team sport for sure.
Yes, I remember. And this is something that I've stated many times. When I was in training and you were talking about team sports and you said, never turn against your teammate. And I thought about that with the horses. But Jim, what I'd like to do is I would love for you to take us on a sequence of your career. And you know, from the time that you first became interested in human potential, like maybe it was high school or college, and then I know a little bit about it, but I don't know the very beginnings, and, you know, how you became so interested and were one of the first people to do the research in sport. And anyway, just tell us your story. Love to hear you.
Okay, well, I don't want to bore people with my story, but I'll try to make it succinct. I ended up quite by accident in applying psychology to human performance. I received my master's and doctorate in psychology, and it was really specializing in mental health and helping people who were struggling with serious mental health issues to help them find their way back to health and well-being. And I became licensed in the state of Colorado, and then I got this big job, which I was very young. I became the executive director and chief psychologist of what was called the San Luis Valley Comprehensive Community Mental Health Center. And we had about a catchment area of 8,600 square miles. We had 9 offices. We were all over central and southern Colorado. And it was a big job, but, you know, I've assumed that's kind of what I would be doing pretty much for the rest of my life. In that catchment area was a college called Adams State College, and I got to know a guy by the name of Dr. Joe Vigil, who's an extraordinary human being. He's an Olympic legend, and his specialty was track and field athletes. And he and I became pretty good friends. He actually got me running, and I would be working with his runners and a lot of the folks that he was training. And he kept asking me the same question, Jim, as a psychologist, What could you tell me that help me to do a better job to get more out of my athletes, my track and field athletes? And I just look at him with like a deer in headlights. And I would go, Joe, I have no clue, because I know how to get people who are not well to get them healthier. But I don't know how, I have no idea of how to take someone who's pretty normal and make them extraordinary. And he said, well, you ought to look into it, Lair. It's going to be big. So he kept pounding me. And finally, I did a literature search. And then after working with some of the athletes at the school that was in the catchment area and with his runners, I decided to take a big leap and to do something that everyone thought I had duly lost my mind. I resigned to a 23-member board of directors. They thought it was a ploy for more money, so they nearly doubled my salary. And I said, oh, no, I apologize. That really wasn't my motive at all. It's not money. I want to go apply psychology to the arena of sport, to human performance. And they looked at me like, what? So they just assumed I couldn't handle the stress, even though our mental health center was doing amazingly well. And I moved to Denver, set up a private practice specializing in performance problems of athletes. And I really, I didn't know anything. I mean, there were no psychologists. There were very little published. So I felt like I had to go where I could learn. And so Jimmy Connors was probably the best competitor in tennis in the world at that point. And he was starting up a new tennis center in South Florida at Sanibel. And they were looking for someone to run the facility, this guy by the name of Bob Davis. And I said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll run the facility, but I want to have access to Jimmy, and I want to learn, do videos with him, and really study how his brain works. He said, no problem. So I spent 2 years there, and then I realized I still didn't know much of anything. It was still so primitive in terms of what I knew. And Nick Bollettieri asked me if I would consider setting up my research institute at his facility. And I became director of sports psychology and sports science for the Nick Bollettieri Tennis Academy. And I was there for 6 years. And that, for me, was where I learned everything. It was, I had access to 240 of the best tennis players in the world, developing tennis players. It was the most prolific period of player development in the history of tennis. And I collected so much data. I still have boxes of data. And I had Andre Agassi and David Wheaton and Jim Courier, Monica Seles, and on and on. And then after that, I felt like I finally had an idea of how I would like to do or make a contribution in this area. So I joined forces with a guy by the name of Jack Groppel, Dr. Jack Groppel, who had his PhD in bioengineering. And we started a company called the Human Performance Institute. And and that was formed in 1992, located it in a place called Lake Nona in Orlando. And that's where you went. I would say to date, we probably had over 400,000 people go through the Institute at 2.5-day programs. It was quite a success story. We worked with 17 number ones in the world and all kinds of people below number ones, the military, special forces. Our mission was to help individuals and teams perform to the upper level of their talent and skill in high-stress, extreme environments, with one caveat, and that was without losing their health and happiness. We had a sense that if you just crashed in to the arena and really didn't take care of yourself well, it was going to be a short trip. And so we had no idea how big that was going to be, but we actually were on the right channel. And so we developed a company that really we had a lot of people in the corporate world, sports world, and we had a lot of folks in medicines. We had doctors, attorneys, nurses, all kinds of folks from diverse areas of you know, really specialty. And in 2008, Johnson & Johnson just went crazy over our company and put a full-court press on us to sell it to them. So we sold the company in 2008. I stayed on for another 6 years helping with the transition. And then they built this massive new facility. We had a 9-acre beautiful campus and were very profitable, but they wanted something more, you know, extraordinary. So they built about just you know, 5 minutes from where we were in Medical City, and it is now kind of the face of J&J. It's a magnificent facility called the Johnson & Johnson Human Performance Institute. So it was an evolutionary experience for me. Every year or two, we were able to peel back. We're a research-based group. We're trying to figure out, how is this system engineered? The more we understand the physical, the emotional, the mental, and actually character, the spiritual side, the better chance we'll have of actually developing programs that take people where they want to go under extreme stress. And we work with the Blue Angels Precision Flying Team and all kinds of people where failure was not just like in sport, you lose the game. These are mission critical. Someone could die if you don't execute and complete the mission. So I've written 17 books, and every book I've written actually is another, kind of for me, it was another milestone of understanding. It helped me understand something that was, I felt, a critical piece to the puzzle. So in the beginning, and I know you read Mental Toughness Training for Sports, and that was the beginning of my kind of really deep dive into this whole arena of mental toughness. And I've learned so much more. I only wish that I knew then what I know now, because we'd have done a lot of things differently. You know, from the powerful engagement to the power of story, training parents for competition, and then the only way to win, and leading with character. All the books actually represent another chapter in our research that we gained more understanding about how human beings actually operate. So I feel very, very fortunate to have, this has been a living laboratory of high performance from every arena of life. And I feel like I was so fortunate. I miss it terribly. I really regret, you know, kind of having sold the company, because I was like a kid in a candy store. We could find more and more ways to unlock the Rubik's Cube and to try to understand this complex, really, design that we have as human beings, and how do we get the most out of it, and what are the most important levers to push to get people to do things they never imagined were possible. So you were there kind of in the seminal period, and then you started to develop your own kind of mental toughness training program for writers. I was really taken with your diligence, with how hard you really studied. You were a very detail-oriented person, and you really wanted to make a contribution. And I'm sure that the contributions you've made, first of all, you were an elite world-class performer yourself. And then for you to speak about what it takes to be a world-class performer, it really, people listen, because you've been there, you've done that. You were in the arena of high performance, demonstrated you knew something about it because you were able to capture these amazing titles. And then to have you as a coach is like, what a privilege. I'm sure people have felt that they had the inside lane when it came to someone who understood how to get the horse and the rider on the same page, and how to control these powerful hormones of stress, these adrenal cortical hormones, because you're not only doing it for yourself, but you're doing it for, quote, the team, which means the horse. So I hope that wasn't too long an overview of the kind of career, but I ended up by accident. In fact, a lot of the things I learned by accident. I never really, particularly in the character space, but I've been very lucky and been surrounded by amazing people. I would say one of the things I'm most proud of was the faculty that we brought together at the Institute. I mean, we were literally, I think, second to none with a staff that understood human performance like no one else does. We had former commander of the SEALs, former commander of the Blue Angels. We had Navy SEALs. We had all kinds of people who had demonstrated, like Olympic gold medalists, silver medalists. And when these folks speak, people listen, because they've actually been there and they understand it. And so that was my greatest pride, was the faculty that we assembled. They've all kind of gone their own way now that Johnson & Johnson is kind of ruling the roost. But that was my proudest accomplishment, I think, is bringing together an extraordinary group of people, very much like you. You're an accomplished performer, and when you speak, if we were going to look to an equestrian division, you're the only person, I think, that could hold that banner, and everyone would listen to your teachings because you are the real deal.
Well, thank you for those awesome compliments, and I'm very grateful. And that being said, it's what you taught me is what I passed on. And I think that it must be an incredible sense of fulfillment for you to know that through all of these people that you've taught, that you have touched the lives of so many people. I mean, that is, you'll just never know, and none of us ever know, really, the lives that we touch.
You know, that's right. It's true with anyone who's in this kind of coaching world. I have this reverence. I think of myself as a coach more than anything. And that I have such respect and reverence for coaches, and if they really understand the power they have to make a difference in people's lives. And coaching is a special calling. And, you know, like you say, you never know. I get people from all over the world telling me what happened in their lives as a consequence of the teachings, coaching. And, you know, I'm kind of blown away because you don't really know. You plant the seeds and you hope something happens. And I'm sure the very same things happen with you in your coaching. You get people coming back and, you know, because I'm an old guy, I now have, you know, people asking me to work with their kids who, because it had such an impact on their lives, they want to do the same thing for their young children because they're performers as well in school and in dance or whatever it is they're doing and in sports and college. High school, junior high. So you never know what the ripple effect is going to be, but I think it's a great privilege to be able to have that center lane into people's lives. And I've really come to understand that all you're doing is you're leveraging something like tennis or golf or the equestrian arts and so forth, to help people grow up and become stronger in every area of their life. And it's not just to get them to win titles, but to actually help them become better, more fully functional human beings because of what they're doing. And it's hard and it's grueling and their disappointments and their injuries. And it just goes on and on. But this is a compressed version of life. And often the consequences are not nearly as severe as they are if those were occurring in real life. And so you really have an opportunity to help people understand, you know, things that are critical in life without having to fall clear from the top of the ladder all the way to the ground. They actually can begin to mobilize the necessary tools to navigate through very difficult storms in life. And they learned all those fundamentals in their work with a coach, with you as their coach. And I think that's the awesome nature of a competitive sport, that you can leverage it for really developing incredible strengths in human beings.
Well, Jim, I would love for you to talk about when I, at the point, it wasn't the very beginning, but when you started the Human Performance Institute originally, and what I recall, and I know this is still a part of what you teach, is it was so centered on the ability to transform emotion and energy onto the positive side of the matrix and develop the ideal performance state and to be able to get into that state. Anyway, explain that a little bit. And then from there, when you were talking about the books were your stepping stones, I'd really love to hear the stepping stones and really where that's brought you to and how it all works together. Because I know that it's never really completely separate, because when our son passed away, it was because of what the work that I had done with you that taught me how to walk through that, or helped me know how to walk through that, like recovery and those kinds of things. But anyway, I would just love for you to share with people, because some of the people who are listening to this are like, I know that they're so excited to hear your voice and to hear you talk, because they've heard about you from me for 25 to 30 years. And then other people are not as familiar with your teachings and your structure and strategy and all of those things. So if you don't mind, maybe kind of starting and then building. And I'd love to hear it too.
Okay. Well, I'm sure you have your own language around this, and you've learned so many of this on your own terms, which is really exciting and really the way in which it becomes real for you. But so when I was in the sport of tennis, and I was trying to understand how do you teach, let's say, a great forehand or a great backhand or a great serve, the way in which I went about it was I would take the best forehands in the world or the best serves in the world, and I would take a look at what do all of those people, if possible, what are the things they all do the same? And if you found out if all the 10 best forehands or serves do all these things, those must be something that are really critical to being extraordinary. So I said, now if we're going to try to figure out how do you develop a competitive mind that's extraordinary, what are the things that you have to do to make that happen? Our brain is obviously one of the most complicated but most important capacities we have as human beings. It separates us from the animal kingdom in many ways. So I said, well, let's go out and let's look at how the very best in the game, let's ask them, what do they feel like? What are the descriptors they use when they are actually playing at the peak of their ability? Sometimes it's called zoning. I refer to it as their ideal performance state. And so I would ask them, and then I would record all of that. And I did it with 23 different sports. And the more I did it, the more shocked I became, because it was like, whether it was football or basketball or baseball or tennis or golf or diving or anything else, the words that athletes chose when they were really in this peak performance state were so amazingly similar. And so I started to put together the ones that were nearly common to all great competitors. And that formed the basis of what I later came to call one's ideal performance state. What the kinds of things that showed up in their vocabulary and their descriptors are things like, I felt very calm. I felt high energy. I felt very relaxed. I felt very positive. I felt very automatic, as if almost everything was coming to me automatically, almost intuitively. So I got, and there were 12 of these that I finalized because they kept showing up. And then I looked at them more closely and I realized some are mental, like focus in the moment, at the present moment. Some are emotional, like positive or challenged or optimistic. Some were physical, like being relaxed, being loose, and there's a sense of kind of freedom in their muscles. Some were, kind of at the spiritual level, in a sense. They felt that their energy was really quite different than what it might normally be. They felt inspired, which what I call the energy of the human spirit. They felt like they were doing it, but someone else was almost doing it. It was almost so automatic, and it was such a joyous feeling. So I began to realize that this special state was not just mental. So as our understanding went further. It's mental, it's emotional, it's physical, and it actually has something to do with the spirit, with a purpose, with why they're doing it, with an understanding of the importance of, you know, getting their why right, for why they're competing, why they're doing this. And that was a really important breakthrough. And so then you wonder, well, what is causing all of that? What we came to realize that there is an underlying physiology that bubbles up when you get mentally and emotionally and physically and actually even spiritually in the right place. There's an underlying chemistry. Your stress hormones that are a very low level, the oscillation frequency of your brain in terms of what is referred to as electroencephalographic recording is not at a rapid kind of beta level. You have, measurements of the amount of tension in your extensor muscle or your bicep or tricep, you see there's low levels of muscle tension. And there is an activation that is occurring, and which comes first? The system actually works both ways. What you think affects the chemistry. How you act affects the chemistry. The sleep, your diet, your nutrition affects the chemistry. And what you're trying to do is get as many of the factors that are under your control. You'll never have a direct trigger that you can just say, okay, ideal performance state or IPS now. That isn't how it works, but you'll go in and out of it. And the more you practice it, the better your body will get skills at controlling it. So we spent years trying to, you know, everything from meditation to, you know, tracking sleep. We were really very big on habits and rituals that you get into that actually make it much easier for you to go into a competitive arena, high stress, and just light it up. And it's because your energy or the sense of confidence, which is emotional, your ability to focus on the present moment, not in the future or in the past, staying right with what you're doing, I call that full engagement. And so there is, we have controls over this, but it's not as direct. That's why athletic competition is so interesting. You never know who's going to get kind of rolled over by the nerves, or emotions run red hot and they get angry and upset, or they're just low on energy, they haven't eaten, slept, they've been on planes, and they really don't understand why they actually should even be out here. They're starting to question their motives, and the why just isn't there. So it's and that's the beauty of competitive sport. And it's the beauty of any, whether it's a surgeon in a surgical suite, doing a really difficult surgery, or in any kind of corporate, what we call them, corporate athletes. It's the same for everyone. And the more you learn how to control that ideal performance state, the more consistent your performance will be. You'll still have bad days, but not nearly as many and not nearly so ugly. And because you've really figured out how to get your chemistry to the right place, which activates all these amazing systems. You know, it's a learning process for the rest of everyone's life. How to be at your best when you want it or need it most. How do you bring the best version of yourself forward? And we're all performing as mothers, as fathers, as sons, as daughters, as competitors in sport. We have a performer self, and then we have just kind of our real self. The more we can leverage a lot of this understanding that we've acquired over almost 40 years, the more you feel like maybe I can do this. And even if you're in the later stages of life, you can get so much better, whether you're public speaking or whether you're in front doing presentations to your company executives or whatever it is, you realize, you know, we're performing here, and it's the very same skills that we need to perform in a competitive arena in sport. The sport was just a great arena for learning them and applying them now in arenas that actually do matter, because sport oftentimes is fun, but it really doesn't matter in the long run.
What I think is so interesting that with such a couple things that were so compelling for me is that it was a skill that you could learn
mm-hmm.
by thinking of tools, how you thought. There were some thinking tools as I mm-hmm. think about it, and what you do with your body, those were tools. So you could kind of use your own version if you knew what the tools were to get your, as long as you were aware that you were not where you wanted to be, you could come back to that. And the other thing is that if you didn't get to that, you were always going to perform below. But your true potential of talent and skill, but I was like the second coming or something to know that you could learn tools. I mean, it wasn't so mystical. It wasn't just some mental, you know, heebie-jeebie. It was very much mind, body, emotion. So that's what I loved about it. And really, it changed my career. You know, I immediately started doing much better. I started to understand it. I did it with my horses. And, you know, we don't learn it in school. And it's a big deal, I think.
Well, and that was part of, you know, my quest was to demystify this thing that we call, you know, mental toughness, because most people didn't have a clue as to what it meant, and you either had it or you didn't. And the idea that you could actually train it in people, just like we train anything, was quite liberating. And we actually demonstrated it over and over and over again in every arena of high performance. And, you know, I like science, and so I'm always looking at, you know, how the neurology of the human brain can help us understand the process, how hormones that are released into the system actually impact our ability to execute at high levels and to control the release of these powerful adrenal cortical hormones associated with stress and fear. And for me, the thing with the arena that you're in, you're not only doing it for yourself, you're also doing it for the horse. And you have to be able to understand what are the levers you can push to get your horse to actually enter their ideal performance state, to be relaxed and calm and confident and energized and excited in the arena, as opposed to fearful or kind of dreading it. But they have emotions like humans do. And they are clearly able to read tension in your body through their senses, just from sitting on their back. And also, I think the sense of smell, there's some data that they actually can smell stress hormones, so that when you're in a very bad state, that's very quickly communicated to the horse, and they get very edgy because they're sensing danger and they're not nearly as tuned into what's happening right now. So they tend to make mistakes, just like people outside of the envelope that are, you know, in your competitive arena. The same thing is true with them. I mean, they've got to figure out how to clear this, you know, these contaminations that occur very quickly. Someone gets upset about something, you know, you make an unforced error in tennis or a bad shot in golf, you have to really quickly reset. You have to be highly resilient. For me, the big awakening was, hey, if you can do this in sport, well, let's really apply it to the arenas that actually matter most in life. And how about teaching these to your kids through sport? This will be a gift for a lifetime. And that, I think, is part of the brilliance that you bring in the equestrian world, that you actually, the skills you teach are life skills that just don't apply to riding and to work with the equestrian arts. I mean, I think that's for me a very exciting part of what it is you do. I've always appreciated kind of you have kind of this inquisitive side of you that is just very, and it's not just on the surface. You want to know as much as humanly possible, which I think is a great sign as a coach or a teacher. You want to know the reasons. You want to know what is the real meaning behind all this. you're a great student, and I picked that up very early in my interactions with you, and that always is one of the things I respected you for, was you're thorough. You don't just come out and read a book and come out and apply it, or listen to a tape from Jim Lehrer and you got it. You put it through a lot of, you know, different screens to determine if this is actually going to fit. Is it work? Can I use this in my own work, with my own clients, with my writers, and so forth? You know, I really appreciate the devotion that you brought to this, and your willingness to just dig and dig and dig until you really got to some answers that you think made sense.
Well, I feel like I'm just beginning to learn.
Yeah, we all do, though. I mean, that's it. We're just, this system we're trying to run is so complicated. And the more science we get, the more we realize we don't know anything about anything.
Yes. Well, one of the things that I really loved in one of your stepping stones in your evolution was, because I know early on you were really studying the athletes who did well consistently and mm-hmm. just all we were talking about. And then you began to talk about how if they only thought about their success as by the external scorecard or the mm-hmm. championship, that was really insatiable. And then your work, I should let you say this because I might not be saying it accurately, took a deeper direction and it just kept expanding. That's a better way to say it. So I'd love for you mm-hmm. to talk about external results. And
yeah, no, it was a big discovery. We were so fortunate to work with people who had scaled to the top of the mountain in their sport. They were number one in the world in their sports. And yet over and again, we found these people very dissatisfied somehow. You know, they were excited and joy to win a world championship, be number one, but it didn't last long. And in fact, it was very predictable that within a relatively short period of time, they were going, well, is this it? I've been working my whole life just for this. And they think, well, I won an Olympic medal. Maybe I need to win two just to make sure that I know it wasn't luck. So they get two and then three and four and whatever it is. But there's not a lot of inner satisfaction, which to me was really interesting. For any of your listeners, I would recommend they read, if they're interested in this area, read the book Open by Andre Agassi. Because he was told, it's a brilliant read, and it's so honest. It's shocking about how open and honest he was with his readership. He was told he would be, you know, very happy, contented, fulfilled, he'd have a great life. And he was tortured at the Nick Baldry Tennis Academy, in his own words. He felt like he was in prison. But everyone said, if you just become really wealthy and famous and make money, all your dreams come true, you'll be happy. Well, he became number one in the world. He had everything, he had every imaginable thing he could ever want. And he was he felt he'd been hoodwinked, that all these things were not true. He sank from one in the world to 141 in the world, his ranking. And he and his physical trainer by the name of Gil Reyes just kind of stepped outside and started to do deep reflection. And he began to realize that, you know, this whole journey for him was all about himself. It was all about him. And that wasn't really very fulfilling. Just to be chasing fame and money and the hope that he would really be happy. And so he changed the reason he played tennis. And he'd always wanted to help kids who, in Nevada, who just never had a chance to have a decent life, decent education, never get to college. He started a college preparatory school in Nevada. I think he raised somewhere around $60 million. He put all of his money and fame and everything. He dropped his wig. He just decided, I want to do something that's real, and I would like to make a contribution that has very little to do with winning for me. So he he did this, what I think, incredible mobilization in his life to help, to use what he had done with his life to help others, and particularly kids. I went to his Hall of Fame induction, and there were all of these young people who had been through his school and talked about how he had changed their lives. And I will tell you, there was not a dry eye in the place. But the most intriguing part of the story is that once he established the right purpose, he again started the ascent from 141, became number one in the world again. And absolutely people adored him in ways that they had never, ever seen before, because he really wasn't talking about himself. He was really, as he said, almost, quote, "I had the wrong goals." So the idea that we all kind of have what I call a hidden scorecard, and it comes from our ancestors, that how we treat others is a major reference point for what kind of human being we are. And the reason that is true is because those who were kind of the renegades, the outliers, the real independent cusses who went off and did their own thing, none of them survived. The only way you could survive in those primitive conditions was there would be times when you had to rely on others to make it. And he's, you know, the idea that who we are is who we were, that those individuals who began to show a deep concern for others, and when they needed help, you know, there were people who would step up, and vice versa. When you needed help, you had someone. And those who didn't develop this trustworthiness, caring, compassion, kindness, concern for others, they didn't survive. And we now are part of that. And so we have this hidden scorecard, and that is our treatment of others. And even if you get to the top of the mountain, you're only as good, if your scorecard is extrinsic success, you're only as good as your last performance. So you're going to constantly have to have that filled with another adrenaline hit, or you're going to feel empty. And when you get the scorecard right, which is actually this intrinsic measure of how you see yourself as another human being relative to others, you know, something changes. And so there is an important understanding that we all are part of something much bigger than ourselves, and that our history predetermines in many ways what we're going to do and how we're going to respond in situations that are similar to what we've been talking about. So I really think, so I have people kind of keep tabs of that scorecard. We make 10 to 12 moral and ethical choices every single day in terms of how we treat people. It could be the valet attendant, could be a waitress or waiter who was arrogant or rude or made it wrong. How we treat others, it goes directly to the soul of how we feel about ourselves. And it doesn't manifest for quite some time. So one of the big breakthroughs that I came to realize, and it sounds maybe a little crazy, but maybe soft, and that is that the more you realize that your life was a gift, and your life really has nothing to do with you, it has to do with what you can do for other people. And the more you give your life away, the more you get a life. And the more preoccupied you are with your own happiness and your own fulfillment, the less life comes to you. So we spend a lot of time with young people helping them to understand a calling that what is called self-transcendent, a calling that's much bigger than themselves, actually in the service of others, maybe the community, the school. And so we're relational human beings. That's how we're wired. Extrinsic markers of success are powerful, and they drive us, but they don't give us such deep and sustaining feelings that I am a decent human being, and I feel like I have value. My only value, ultimately, is how I'm doing on these extrinsic markers of success, and if I do well there, I feel good, but it doesn't last very long.
I love that. Well, you also talked, Jim, about character and purpose. Mm-hmm. So I think that, I'm not sure, I probably missed some of the steps along the way of your career development. Talk to us about that.
So this is another accident for me. It was nothing in my training as a psychologist who led me into the character space. I just assumed character was a thing of philosophy or religion, or, but it really didn't have no legitimate place in the world of high performance. Boy, was I wrong. When we began to look deeper into all these folks who were in the high performance arena, we noticed something that really was quite extraordinary. First of all, we learned that purpose is the centerpiece of everyone's life story, and that you have to have a purpose that sustains you. The number one predictor of performance is drive. It's more important than talent or mental toughness or anything else. Is drive. Drive is the thing that it's energy. It releases energy into the system. It takes you into the energy vault and opens the door. And there is virtually nothing that's going to stand in your way. If you're passionate enough, you can fail repeatedly over and over and over again in making the light bulb, and you're not going to be deterred. You're going to find the answer. You're going to get to the goal line. So we were interested in knowing what kind of a purpose actually sustains that. Is it any kind of purpose, or is it just a very specific kind of purpose? And what we learned was that the purpose that actually, again, takes you outside your own obsession with your own greatness and success, when you're fighting for a cause bigger than yourself, like in the military, you'll jump on a grenade to save the lives of your comrades. And bravery and courage under fire often requires an understanding of purpose that is way beyond just simply wanting to be cool or wanting to win medals or wanting. Nobody jumps on a grenade to win a medal. But in a sense, it's kind of the same with our world. We're not in a military battle, but we have to have energy to do things in our life. And we have to figure out what opens the door. Energy is the most precious resource we have. Nothing happens without energy mobilization. And we, because our ancestors, again, were very conservation conscious, when food was scarce and water was scarce and shelter was scarce, they developed kind of a stingy mentality about their energy, you know, investments, unless it was absolutely essential for survival. And those that just kind of squandered their energy when every calorie counted and they didn't have the abundance of everything we have today, they didn't make it. So we're all part of that heritage. And we don't want, if we can, you know, use a channel changer, we'll sit there for 2 hours and watch TV we don't like because we don't want to get up. We call it laziness. But, you know, our ancestors were lazy except when it came to doing something that aided survival. Well, today we have all the food, we have all the water, we have shelter, but we're still conservators of energy. And so the big issue is, what opens the vault? If you want to have a big life, you have to be a big spender. You have to understand, first of all, what are your values? What is it you really want to spend your energy on that's going to give you the greatest return? And you need to be all in. And that's what full engagement is. It's the ability to invest the full and best energy you have as a human being in what you're doing right here, right now. And so we found that purpose opens the vault. And the right kind of purpose opens the vault, you know, a mile wide. And you'll push all the way till there's no energy left even to get your heart to beat. If it's big enough, you'll give your life. And so what the most important thing for us was, let's understand that purpose. And what is the purpose that really sustains us and keeps us at the top of the mountain for a very long time? And ironically, it's not something that is all about you. We found out that this self-transcending purpose is the thing that actually drives us to continue to the end of our lives. And it, you know, you may achieve great things in the process, but it was never really, the goal was never just to achieve for the sake of achievement. So we asked folks over and again, to go to the end of their life. If you really want to know, you know, what a successful life is, let's go to the end of your life and let's try to figure out what that is so that we can work backwards. So the first thing we ask them, who are you when you're most proud of yourself? When you are, I mean, you are literally the best version of yourself that you can be. Write down 6 words that describe who you are when you are literally on fire and you're happy with how you're dealing with life and the challenges of life. And when we had people do that and we were doing it in a workshop format, I would either ask them to stand and read those 6 words or I would read them to the class, and everyone was shocked because they all wrote down basically the same things. No one said when I'm winning, when I'm, you know, pushing the envelope and forcing everyone to the sidelines. And there were things like patient, kind, when I am, when I'm fully engaged with what's happening in the moment. And they would go on and on. And again, it took us back to their connection to other people. And then we asked them to write 6 or 8 words that if they could inscribe or design their own tombstone at the end of their life, what would they like inscribed? What are the 6 words they would like inscribed on that tombstone that if in fact it was true, this would be the perfect life for them? And so they would write down, they would take a lot of time and think about it. And then I would read those to the class where they would stand up and everyone was equally shocked. The same thing happened. This was a person who was an inspiration to others, who was kind always, always stepped up to help, positive, was a spark plug for great causes in helping the world become a better place, whatever it is. And so again, brought us back to the treatment of others, which opened the door for us to character. And there are 2 kinds of character. One is what I call performance character. And these are the skill sets that enable you to scale the mountain, become an unbelievable achiever. So things like focus and discipline and time management and being punctual. And, you know, I've listed 25 of the most important that, and these all are assets that you can acquire, and they will help you become an amazing, amazing performer, achiever in life. But they in no way have any connection to ethical or moral treatment of other people. Bernie Evers, or if you look at any of the folks who's gotten themselves into real trouble, they had a boatload of these performance assets, but they had some holes in their moral and ethical character large enough for an 18-wheeler to drive through. And the moral and ethical character is, again, how you treat others, which is the gold standard of health, which is where the hidden scorecard comes from. We are, as I said, we are who we were. And our treatment of others, there is somehow, our brain is just keeping track of that. And if we treat people kindly and we care about them deeply and we have compassion and we show that we have respect for others, we are trustworthy, we speak the truth, we're honest, we have a lot of success, but we're very, very humble, we're grateful for what we have. These are moral and ethical assets that we found are the keys to sustained performance at the top. As I said, this is not something that I ever read or was prepared to encounter in my work. It came out of this massive database when we had people going through programs that we would put them on a 90-day program. We would look at their success or failure in 18 months. And the more insights we got, the more I was like moved. And that's why the last 10 years of my life, I've written 2 books. On character and the role that character plays in people's fulfillment in life, on satisfaction in terms of who they are, and even in sustained success and achievement. You can get to the mountain, top of the mountain, by climbing over dead bodies and by not paying any attention to anyone, but that you're not going to stay there long, and the fulfillment that you have is going to be very short-lived based on the work we did at the Institute. For me, it's an evolutionary tale. I just wish, as I said, we didn't have these insights. One of the big insights that came, it's going to make you, it's probably the biggest insight I had in my entire career. And when I tell it to you, and your listeners are going to go, wow, it's the Lehrer Guide, is a very slow learner. Doesn't everyone know that? And it was simply this, that health ignites performance. We learned that we were simply in the health business, helping people do things that were absolutely unimaginable, helping them to achieve, you know, objectives that they never dreamed maybe were ever possible, certainly for them. And all this issue of mental toughness and all the things that we were doing, we realized what we were actually helping people do was to become healthier as human beings. And health is physical, where they're becoming more flexible, stronger, they eat right, they slept better, they took breaks better, they've learned how to recover quickly, their cardiovascular fitness improved, whether it be a chess champion or whether it be a lineman in professional football. We got their bodies physically healthier. And then we got them healthier emotionally, where they actually had access to positive, opportunistic, challenge-based emotions, which is really the purest form of emotional energy. Then we helped them mentally to get their story straight, to get the right mindset, to get their inner private voice aligned with who they wanted to be, and to help them focus in the moment and not look forward or back when they're in those critical periods. And that's just health. It just makes them healthier as a person. And then the highest level of health was spiritual health. Their ability to actually connect and find fulfillment in their relationships with other people and how they treated other people. And so we realized that if you want to become extraordinary, you really start with the spiritual. You start with purpose, values, ethics, how you treat people. Then you develop a mindset, a scorecard. You develop a way of thinking. You focus your energy on those things. Then you summon the emotions that actually serve that mission. And then you take care of yourself so you never run out of energy, because energy production actually occurs in the physical body. We get energy from no other place other than the cells of the body and the mitochondria of the body and the union of oxygen and glucose. If you run out of glucose, if you run out of oxygen, energy production suffers. And our ancestors got that, but you know, it's a little harder because we have so many things that are complicating our understanding of what is physical health today. We have so many options. But that's what we did, and that's why Johnson & Johnson purchased the Human Performance Institute, because they were in the health business, and they realized with our data, they now are in the performance business. And we were in the performance business, and we suddenly realized, you know, really, we're in the health business. And if you want someone to perform better, all you got to do is get them healthier in all dimensions. And I'm sure that's true with horses as well, that the healthier the rider, the healthier the horse, the better it is that they're going to perform under pressure.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Wow, Jim. I love that. What an evolution. And I think it's your tenacity in working with all the people and really continuing to study, to have that curiosity. I'm just going to ask you one more question, and because I'm so grateful for all of your time. And I would love for you to talk about the private voice, because that's something that is a challenge for all of us.
Exactly.
Could you tell people what that is? And
I'd be happy to. So we all have a public voice, which is what I'm speaking to you now from. And we all have an inner private voice. And the only person that hears that is the person who is actually speaking to themselves. And that it's the only voice you'll have until your final day, and that no one hears but you. And most people thought in the beginning that this is just like moving air around inside your head. There's no consequence. You can call yourself a jerk. You can have this conversation, this monologue with yourself in it. You can belittle yourself. You can be a critic. You can, and in some ways you might think, well, that's probably a way that I will help myself be better. I'll be harsh on myself. I'll be a harsh critic and I won't be so lazy, or I won't be so easily, swayed off path of what I'm supposed to be doing in life. And actually, that's not true. What we learned was that the power broker in an individual's life, the person that's actually running the show, is the voice that no one hears but you. It's the inner private voice. And that voice can be wildly dysfunctional. And it begins to get formed even in the earliest stages of childhood. There's even some evidence that maybe even prenatally, that the voice is how the mother and father are speaking, that the neonate is actually hearing some of that. But by the age of 5, that voice is starting to take form. And it becomes a very critical force in how you evolve in life. And if you had a very critical mother or father, it really is the amalgamation of a lot of people, authority figures mostly, that were in your life. And eventually it becomes kind of your voice, but it's really not your voice. It's the voice of others. And what I spent a lot of time, just I could spend hours on this, but one of the ways that we got to this was at the academy, I had everyone wear remote microphones, and I would ask them to tell me to say out loud what they were saying to themselves, just say it out loud so that we actually had some idea of what their private voice was saying during a match, during competition. So if they missed an easy forehand, they might say, "You jerk, you're such an idiot," or whatever it is that they might have been saying to themselves. And what we ultimately came to understand is that the most important coach you will ever have in your life is your private voice. Your private voice is the center of everything. It's the master storyteller, and it's the power broker. And if that voice is dysfunctional, you will always have issues. You'll never be completely happy, and you'll never understand why. So we worked very hard to get that private voice aligned with what we might call a world-class coach. A coach that you would say to, let's say you have a best friend that you deeply care about, what would you say to them in the exact same situation you're in that you hope would help them? You wouldn't call them a jerk. You wouldn't call them stupid. You know, you would probably have a message that was encouraging, might have been stern, try to help them get, you know, really back on track in some constructive way. But there is an overriding concern and a wisdom in the voice as you are coaching them. And what we're trying to do is to get people to go to that place because it has become the most valuable source of information for them in their life, that they don't necessarily look outward. They look inward. It's their own personal Yoda, in a sense that if you're constantly working to get that inner voice, you know, really aligned with your purpose, with your values, with who you most want to be, with the best version of yourself, something magical happens. You're no longer dividing yourself. You're no longer fighting, you know, yourself and also trying to fight the world outside if you're a competitor or whatever it is you're doing. So aligning your private and public voice with the best version of yourself, what happens is you start coming across as being very authentic, very genuine, very sincere. And if you have, that's why we hate politicians, because their public voice goes in one direction. They sound fantastic. But when they get into office, it's their private voice that actually runs the show. And we're always trying to figure out, is the person speaking from the inside, or is this public speak? Is it just public speak? And, you know, all of our life we're going to have to work to make sure that this most intelligent repository of wisdom is going to come from our private voice. And we're always trying to make that better and smarter and a constructive force always in our lives. So that even in the most difficult moments when you're struggling, you go inward. And you have this brilliant coach actually inside of you who is sitting on your shoulder, very eager to give you the most, you know yourself better than anyone. And if you finally get what you most want to happen with your life, and you've equipped this private voice with all the messages and values and all the coordinates, all these GPS coordinates that are really so important for you to what I call get home in life, it's amazing the kind of peace that you get because you trust yourself. You don't look outward all the time. You're always interested in other people's input, but you filter it. And then ultimately, the source of wisdom comes from within you. And with every passing year, your private voice becomes wiser, smarter, more. And that voice can be, as I said, can be compassionate to you, can be hard, can be tough-minded, can be stern. But they always have your best interest at heart, just like you do with your best friend if they were in the same situation. So the private voice is a very important part of being an effective, happy, really performing person in a high-stress environment. And again, that was not something that I learned as a graduate student working on a doctorate degree, but I've really come to understand and appreciate the importance of the inner voice.
Jim, I love that. You're such an eloquent speaker. You are, after years of experience, right?
Well, I feel like I'm so fortunate to have had all these experiences. And I try to link it to the journals and to what's happening in the world of science and all these different areas. But I trust my experience because I've had so many years of experience with extraordinary human beings, and we've seen lots of failures and lots of successes. And you try to figure out, well, does it apply to me? Does it apply to my own family? Is this a bunch of junk? Is it just a one-off? Or is this something, this is how we're actually engineered as a species? And the more we can have confidence that we're really beginning to understand all of these variables, we can just have much bigger lives and much bigger lives of contribution. And we can be a lot happier in that process.
I think such a big challenge in all arenas, and by that I mean whether it's business or it's friends or acquiring things or showing in a horse show, is that we're so conditioned to want the external. I mean,
yeah.
And we
to validate
measure,
us, to yes, validate us.
Yes. And so to know that we can have everything, but we have to mine the inner and the values and the character and the performer skills, all of those things, which is our own personal work. That's the other thing, is it's such personal work that you have to put energy into and effort. And I just find that extraordinary and always want to help people understand and then be supported in their own personal journey.
So, you know, I think it's a great, it was another big breakthrough for me. It may sound a little unusual, but I can tell you this is where it's going. And this is, I think, is as close to reality as you can get. And it is simply this, that nothing happens in life without effort, and I call it energy investment. And if you want to have big things happen in life, most of the things that you're most proud of are the things that you've earned, that you actually, through your effort and through mobilizing energy, and you literally take energy from your body and you invest it in something because you think it's going to be important or will add great dimension to your life. But make no mistake about it, it's your energy. If I take energy out of your life, nothing's left. So energy is life. And as long as you can intentionally invest energy, you can have pretty much whatever you want. If you want to have this amazing competitive brain, you can have it. But you're going to have to do a lot of work. It's not normal to have this great competitive brain. You have to work at it all the time. If you want to have a great private voice, you have to work at it. If you want to have this Yoda, personal Yoda, that you go to, you're just not going to get it because you heard this presentation. You're going to have to work to clean up your act. It takes a lot of energy. And you give life to whatever you give your energy to. So if you give a lot of energy to being disappointed or, you know, scapegoating or pessimistic or negative or angry, those are just like biceps and triceps. Those are muscles. Those are acquired capacities. And the more you allow your energy to go there, your thoughts, your way you speak, you invest energy by thinking about them, talking about them, by doing them, acting them out. There's so many ways to invest energy, but you're like a gardener. You can grow whatever you want in your life. And the things that you're going to be most proud of are the things that actually are going to take an enormous amount of energy investment and hard work. And if you put all of your energy into, and your identity is simply going to be how many mountains you've scaled, what you have achieved, how many medals you've won in the equestrian arena, and how many Olympic gold medals you have, we've learned there's going to be a very difficult time. Because that does not fulfill us in the way we had anticipated. But you can get to the top of the mountain with extraordinary energy investment, and you can also build these extraordinary assets that connect you to a purpose much bigger than yourself and to connect to others. That's when you get a grand slam home run, when you have great achievement, but it also, more importantly, you have it in the context of where this all fits in life. If you're only as good as how many medals you've won, you've got a very painful awakening that will come someday. And if you're addicted to the roar of the crowd and that's what gives you a sense of excitement in life, I've been there with an awful lot of world-class, athletes and performers. And it's kind of a sad realization. And so that's why I speak about this, so that people don't get hoodwinked into believing that's what life is all about. It's all about just achievement for the sake of achievement, and that's how I'm going to build a great life, because it simply is not true.
Well, Jim, you've been very gracious, or you are gracious to be with us, and I'm so grateful. And I just want to tell you that going to Florida and being with you is singly the biggest thing that changed the trajectory of my life. And I'm so grateful for you and for your work, and that we've become friends, and how gracious you've always been to me. And, it's just a treat. I admire your science brain. You're always so invested in research, yet such a kind heart and so communicative. And you're just my hero. And I'm just so grateful. Thank you.
Well, I can tell you that I've met a lot of people in my life, a lot of people that I have come to deeply respect, and I really got to know, who they are at the core, and I think I'm pretty discriminating about, people who kind of have this extraordinary presence in the world and have the right stuff. And from the very earliest interactions I had with you, I had this amazing sense that you were one of those people that no matter what you did, you would actually impact and have an enormous influence, and it would always be in a positive way. And then you went through some crises in your own life, and it was very painful to actually see what you had to go through and with all that. But, if I were to say you were one of the stars in the heavens that I've always appreciated and have always said, whatever, in any way I can contribute to her, because I know she is wired right, and I really feel like we've had a great understanding of the right things. And so I appreciate you, I appreciate the contributions you've made, and I really appreciate having the opportunity to have this interaction with you, and I hope we've created some value for all your listeners.
I know, that's number one, right? Well, I think that everybody's going to be looking for the barrel jumping competition. And I just want to comment about this. I don't know if you remember this or not, but this is a funny moment. When I went, it was then called LGE, for the first time, and we just hit it off, and Dr. Grapple and Pat Echeberry, So you said, we're thinking about having coaches in specific sports, like, football and baseball, and I think we'll try it out with you in the horse world. And I'm going, boy, you know how to put some pressure on a girl. Anyway, it was great. I was very grateful. That just shows you how much
respect and confidence I had in you. I could see you just heading up a whole division.
Yeah.
It would be pretty exciting.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your confidence in me. And I wish you all the best. Are you working with youth now?
Yes. We've gone from the Human Performance Institute to the Youth Performance Institute. And I'm trying to apply all the lessons that we learned. So you don't have to be 40 or 50 before you learn these things. We might be able to get these to kids. So I've put a group of people together that are pretty extraordinary. And hopefully we're going to launch your fairly soon. We've been doing stuff for a number of years to get it all, the foundation laid. But I think the goal of mine is with young people and character and helping them understand how to be performers, but in the right context, and to have a balanced life, and to really understand what are the real values that need to be held regardless. So it's with kids, and I'm very excited about that. I hope we can make a big contribution there.
Yes, that is very exciting. Well, I wish you all the best, Jim. It has just been my greatest pleasure. It's like old home week or something. So
it is for me too. And thank you for, you know, offering me this opportunity to connect with you and your listeners.
Yes, yes. Well, you haven't seen the last of me. That's all I had to say.
I hope that's the case.
All right. Well, thank you, Jim,
thank
so
you, Barbara.
Much. Okay.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I've been listening to this interview over and over again to get it to soak into my bones. And I hope you enjoyed it too. And most of all, that you have some takeaways that will move the needle for your life. Have fun, keep believing, hug your horse, and treat yourself and others kindly. Until next time, thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to The Barbara Schulte Show. If you have enjoyed this episode, subscribe to us on your favorite podcast platform, like us on Facebook, and follow us on Instagram to stay tuned for future episodes.